is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, the Rachel Dolezal, I guess it's Dolezal. So I was pronouncing it with a hard Z yesterday. I guess it's a soft Z. Story continues to morph. And I find this fascinating. She was on the Today Show this morning with Matt Lauer. And we'll get to that in just a second. I want to just set a couple of things on the table here as the opening conversation for this hour. Next hour, Mayor Adam O'Neill, the Republican mayor of Belhaven, North Carolina, is going to be here. He was with us some months back in February, I think it was, trying to get North Carolina to expand Medicaid because his hospital is closed and now several people have died in his community. And he'll be telling us about that. And then in our third hour, the Reverend Sally Bingham is going to drop by. She's the president and founder of Interfaith Power and Light. And don't know if she's going to be in the studio. It says, she's going to call in. So anyhow, we're going to get to that. Donald Trump just announced that he is running for president. And the DNC issued Holly Shulman, the secretary of the DNC National Press, released the following statement. Today, Donald Trump became the second major Republican candidate to announce for president in 2 days. He adds some much-needed seriousness that has previously been lacking from the GOP field, and we look forward to hearing more about his ideas for the nation. Yeah. Well, actually, I look forward to hearing Donald Trump's ideas for the nation because there was one day, what was this, 3 years ago? The last presidential election, there was one day when Donald Trump announced that he was considering running for president. And that his main shtick, his main position, would be to blow up all these trade deals, end so-called free trade, and go back to trade the way that we did it before the Reagan administration, go back to tariffs. And he came right out and said it. Now, I don't know if that's still his position, but if it is, I mean, you know, he might pull a Ross Perot inside the Republican Party, because to the best of my knowledge, all the other Republicans are in favor of TPP. Rand Paul might be an outlier in that, but I don't think so. The International Monetary Fund has come out and said Reaganomics, trickle-down economics, what we've been experiencing here for the last 35 years, is stupid and doesn't work. My words, not theirs. These are their words. Raising the income share of the poor and ensuring that there is no hollowing out of the middle class is actually good for growth. The redistributive role of fiscal policy. Redistribution of wealth. Oh, my God. Every Republican's head is exploding in America. This is the IMF. The redistributive role of fiscal policy could be reinforced by greater reliance on wealth and property taxes, more progressive income taxation, roll back the Reagan tax cuts, removing opportunities for tax avoidance and evasion, do away with the Mitt Romney loophole, better targeting of social benefits while also minimizing efficiency costs in terms of incentives to work and save. Very straightforward stuff. It's like, you know, the Bernie Sanders agenda, the IMF. Finally. So anyhow, Rachel Dolezal was on the Today Show today. This is clip number one. This is one of the first questions that Matt Lauer asked her.
Let me just ask you the question in simple terms again, because you've sent mixed signals over the years. Are you an African-American woman?
I identify as black.
And apparently she's creating a differentiation, a separation between being black and being African-American. In other words, she's not genetically, she can't trace her genetics to Africa, but she identifies herself as part of the black culture. And Kareem Abdul-Jabbar has weighed in on this. We'll get to that in just a second. Here's clip number two, where you just using racial identification, which you have, Matt Lauer is saying to her essentially, which you have changed from white to black to white to black over the years. And she said she'd started identifying as black when she was 5 years old, and she was even using crayons to draw pictures of herself with a dark face, brown crayons instead of pink crayons. So here's where Matt says, you know, is this a hustle? Here he is.
When someone said to you back then, are you black or white? And you'd say, I'm black. You didn't say, I identify as right. black. You'd say, I'm black. When did you start deceiving people?
Well, I do take exception to that because it's a little more complex than me identifying as black or answering a question of, are you black or white? I was actually identified when I was doing human rights work in North Idaho as first transracial. And then when some of the opposition to some of the human rights work I was doing came forward and started, the next newspaper article identified me as being a biracial woman. And then the next article, when there were actually burglaries, nooses, et cetera, was this is happening to a black woman. And I never corrected
that. Well, why didn't you correct it? You knew it wasn't true.
Well, because it's more complex than, you know, being true or false in that particular instance.
And then finally, you know, he talks to her about her lawsuit against Howard University, where she sued Howard, the traditionally black college that she attended, because, well, you can listen to it yourself. Here she is.
Your lawsuit against Howard University in 2002, where you claimed you were discriminated against because you were a pregnant white woman. Do you understand how people could hear that and say, here's another example. She says she identified herself as being African-American or black from a young age, but here's a case where she identified herself as a white woman because it worked for her under the circumstances.
The reasons for my full tuition scholarship being removed and my teaching position as well, my TA position, were that other people needed opportunities, and you probably have white relatives and that, you know, that can afford to help you with your tuition. And I thought that was an injustice.
Yeah, so there's that. And now Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, you know, the NBA, former NBA player, he said that she has proven herself a fierce and unrelenting champion for African-Americans politically and culturally. He adds that because, this is, I'm reading from a piece in the Huffington Post by Lucy McCalmont, he adds that because some research has led scientists to find that there is no such thing as race as such, Dalashal has merely selected, these are Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's words, quote, merely selected a cultural preference of which cultural group she most identifies with. So, he writes, does it really matter, this is Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, so does it really matter whether Rachel Dalashal is black or white? Dr. King said we should be judged by the content of our character rather than the color of our skin, which is what makes this case so difficult. So, yes, it does matter. Apparently, lying to employers and the public you're representing when the lie benefits you personally and professionally is a deficit in character. However, the fight for equality is too important to all Americans to lose someone as passionate as she is and who has accomplished as much as she has. And then, of course, Melissa Harris Perry asked the question, you know, could she be trans black the way that Bruce Jenner is a trans woman, or excuse me, Caitlyn Jenner. So culture meet biology, right? What does it mean to be black in America? Bernie Sanders has apparently framed the debate. Graham Greene wrote a great blog over Democratic Underground. He said, you know, this election is going to be about income inequality, wealth disparity, how the billionaires and banksters are controlling our government, about lousy trade agreements, about Medicare for all, about the wealthiest paying their fair share of taxes, less war, more diplomacy, sales tax on stock transactions, tuition-free education for public universities, Black Lives Matter, police brutality, education over prisons, LGBT, Latinos, women's rights, and, you know, $15 minimum wage. How can anybody out Bernie?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, interesting times, interesting stuff going on, and this is just the scratching the surface. We'll continue with this and your calls throughout the day. It's Anything Goes Summer. And welcome back. Let's see here. Victor, watching Free Speech TV in Shippensburg, Pennsylvania. Hey, Victor, what's up?
How you doing, Tom?
I'm well.
I got two issues with it. I don't think that she has the right to say that she's black and she hasn't been discriminated against as most black people have.
Right.
And then my other thing is she's working for the NAACP and she's supposed to be working for black people rights. How can you trust that she'll have your best interests at heart if she just lied to your face?
Well,
that was my two issues with her.
You know, it's sort of like, I think this is where Melissa Harris-Perry was going, is, you know, Bruce Jenner now, or excuse me, Caitlyn Jenner now, is, we refer to her as a she, you know, as a woman, because she made that choice to go from being a man to a woman. If somebody were to choose to identify with black culture and perhaps even alter their appearance a little bit so that they may look like a black person, a light-skinned black person who could be capable of passing as white, but instead she's passing as black, is that a violation of some rule within black culture? Or, I mean, traditionally, it had always been a rule within white culture and one that was enforced by law for over 300 years in this country that a black person couldn't pass as white, but not the other way around, to the best of my knowledge. There was no rule or law against white people trying to pass as black. I mean, who would give up white privilege, as Chris Rock famously riffed? So
it's really no rule within the black community, because in the black community, we accept all races most of the time.
Yeah.
So
although there is a sort of a pecking order within the black community.
That's true, too.
Does have to do with skin color. And that's something that's almost verboten to discuss, and I feel very uncomfortable discussing it. Not being black, I don't have that experience, so I just kind of hear about it from friends who are.
That really comes from being a house slave and the field slave mentality.
Oh, really? Was the house slave typically lighter complexion?
Yes. Uh-huh.
So more likely to be the illegitimate son of the slave owner or daughter of the slave owner, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. See, I'm still learning this stuff. So your take on Rachel Dolezal is, to sum it up, what? What should she do?
My take on it, she already resigned from NAACP. I have some choice words about them, but my take on her is that she could have easily done as a white woman and probably would have been more successful at doing it.
Yeah.
That's pretty much my take on it.
Yeah. Well, that's where Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, he pointed out, you know, she did engage in some deception, and that indicates a deficit in character, but that doesn't mean that the old cliche, throw the baby out with the bathwater, you know, that she still is a passionate defender of African-American rights or black rights. Do we start to separate, I guess, African-American from black, one being genetic and the other being cultural? That seems to be the question at the bottom of all this. Victor, thank you for the call and the conversation. 20 minutes past the hour. I'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman with you. So it seems to me that what Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is basically saying, well, let me take him out of the equation, actually. Well, no, because he said, he came right out and said, she merely selected a cultural preference of which cultural group she most identifies with. Because race is a social construct, social constructs. Culture is a social construct. So are we starting to disentangle race from culture? And if so, and by the way, I think that we have been for some time. And within the African-American community, that probably more contentious 20 years ago than today, but still there, debate about is this particular African-American person trying to be a quote white person by the way that they speak and dress and all that sort of thing, right? Which is really a way of saying, hey, are you trying to not pass as white by appearance, but by culture? And now that's more and more becoming the norm. And at least in some places. And I don't know what to make of this. I find it fascinating. But is this the beginning of a conversation that probably should be happening most aggressively, and I'm guessing probably is. Karen Hunter, by the way, was at the Talkers convention yesterday. She was the other liberal I was trying to think of. And in fact, the day before, I'd been on her show on the Urban Channel on Sirius XM. We didn't talk about race. We talked about TPP, but I'm guessing that she and probably Joe Madison this morning were going into this. I wish I could. I wish I had the time and the ability to listen to their programs. Anyhow, so that's going on. This TPP thing. I want to inform you about what's going on with this TPP thing because it's getting tricky, and as in sneaky tricky. There's going to be a debate starting in 5 minutes in the House of Representatives. And this debate is about a piece of legislation. It's H.R. 2596, called the Intelligence Authorization Act for Fiscal Year 2016. Right? This is an important piece of legislation. They are going to tie to this. They're sticking into this piece of this intelligence bill. They're sticking into it a rule that extends the motion to reconsider, in other words, the ability to vote again on the Trade Adjustment Authority, on the, you know, we're going to appropriate $700 million to help people who lose their jobs because of the TPP. We know how wonderful that's worked, right, over the last 35 years. They're going to extend that until the end of July. And the last time that one of these rules that would allow TPP and TPA were voted on, there were 8 Democrats who deserted the Democratic Party, basically, and voted for it with the Republicans. And they were Earl Blumenauer, Connolly, Cooper, Cuellar, Delaney, E.B. Johnson, Kind, and Larson. And so if those 8 Democrats, I'm wondering, are those 8 Democrats going to once again vote with the Republicans to extend the rules? Because if they can extend the rules so that the vote can happen anytime between now and July 30th, my prediction is that I don't recall if the July 4th holiday this year falls on a Friday or a Monday. But in either case, it's Saturday, people will have Friday off. So my guess is that the vote will happen either Thursday night, or they might even have a special session on Friday so that it just misses the news cycle altogether. And people won't know what's going on. People won't, you know, and then it drops into the memory hole of the weekend. And by the next week, it's yesterday's news, and let's move on, and let's not look behind us and all this kind of stuff. So this rule that has been inserted into the intelligence bill, if the intelligence bill passes with this rule, then, frankly, it's going to be a heck of a lot easier for them to pull this thing off. So you may want to call your member of the House of Representatives, 202-225-3121. I realize this is getting complicated, all this parliamentary procedure. But basically, 202-225-3121. And if you're calling a Republican, you could say, I stand with Donald Trump, stop Obamatrade. And no TPP. And if you're calling a Democrat, you don't need to say I stand with Donald Trump. And if you're calling a Democrat, particularly one of these guys, Blumenauer, Connolly, Cooper, Cuellar, Delaney, E.B. Johnson, Kind, or Larson, just say, you know, please don't betray us again, is how I would put this. So I want to talk about swing voters, too. This is a fascinating concept. We'll be back, and we'll pick up your calls.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
We'll be right back with your calls after this. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, Kansas, we've talked about this a couple of times over the last week or so, but now it's official, I guess. Last Friday they had the vote. More than half. Kansas got thrown into a virtually a $1 billion hole by Sam Brownback cutting taxes on rich people, right? And cutting income taxes, cutting them to zero. If you are rich and you own a business and you just pass your income through your business, it's not taxed for the purposes of state income taxes. Whereas average working people, of course, have to pay a state income tax on every penny they earn because they don't happen to own a corporation. And, of course, and one of the Koch brothers lives in Kansas. That's got to represent a fair amount of money. So they're jacking up the cigarette and sales tax. That's going to raise $384 million. But, of course, it's going to hit the majority of these are going to hit people making less than $50,000 a year. And, in fact, you had this tax credit for grocery purchases is capped at $500, and you can't claim it if you make more than $30,600 a year. Another quarter of the revenue comes from the tax deduction changes, which also appear to be regressive. This is from a piece by Alan Pike over at Think Progress. Given data on what classes of earners have claimed which kinds of deductions in the past, only 6% of the new money is going to come from people who escaped all income taxes in the past 2 years. They're taking, you know, as I said, they eliminated all income taxes on rich people who have a business that they can cycle their money through. So now they're taking that, they're going back 1/9, a little more, you know, like 11 or 12% of what it used to be. So they're dialing that back just a little bit. So anyway, fascinating stuff. But as promised, your calls. Joyce in Deer Lodge, Montana. Hey, Joyce, what's up?
Good morning, Tom, and I want to pick your thoughts. Have you explained to me your thoughts on the puzzle that I believe I have the missing piece for? And that puzzle is, why is it that the Republicans who have blocked the president from the day he took office until now, that they are hand in glove on this TPP?
Right.
My belief is, the piece to that puzzle is that our president owes big money. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I've said on the air before, I don't know what's in his heart. I don't know what's in his history. I don't know if somebody sat him down back in 2006 or 7 and said, you know, I'll make you president or I'll help make you president, but here's what I want in exchange. And the TPP was it. I don't know if it's that. Or if somebody said, hey, you know, Bill Clinton's worth $115 million now. If you want to be like that, here's what you do. I don't know if it's that. Those are really cynical, right? I ran into a progressive member of the House of Representatives over the weekend, and in fact, we had he had a beer, I had a glass of orange juice, as I recall. But anyhow, we had a drink together, and I said, and he's one of the guys leading the charge against President Obama and the TPP on this. And I said, you know, what do you think is his motivation? I mean, the best I can come up with is, you know, he's either been threatened or bribed, basically. And this guy said, I think that his trade representative, I forget the guy's name, Mickey somebody or other, whoever it is, the guy who's responsible for trade in the White House, he says, I think that the president doesn't really understand economics all that well. He was a constitutional law professor. He's not an economist. And I think, and Lawrence Summers was his first advisor, and Lawrence Summers just wrote an op-ed for, I think it was the New York Times, pushing for the TPP. He said, I think that he's just being given bad advice, and he's believing the people that he's surrounded himself with. And the same may have been true for Bill Clinton. And I thought, and I said, well, that's a very charitable, you know, explanation for somebody who's working as aggressively against him and this as you are. And this guy said, well, yeah, but it's what I think. He said, I don't think that President Obama is somebody who can easily be bought off or threatened. He said, I think that this is really, he's got bad advice. So I don't know, Joyce. I hadn't considered that he could be in such a bubble in the White House and have such a small number of advisors that, you know, one or two people who are advising him on economic policy could just steer him, you know, basically off, you know, off the gangplank into the water. I just don't know. Joyce, thanks for the call. Carrie in Orange County, Colorado, you wanted to talk about Rachel Dolezal. Hey, Carrie.
How you doing, Tom? Hey, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing excellent. Yeah, so I wanted to, you brought up something with regards to the, you know, her position on black versus African-American.
Right, black being cultural, African-American being genetic, essentially is what she seems to be saying.
Well, I want to say something about that. I think that, you know, I think I have a unique perspective on it, like going back to the 80s. And I grew up in the suburbs, and actually I went back and forth, you know, in my junior high school years and whatnot, from the suburbs to, you know, where I went to school, to another part where my the rest of my family lived. And there was a real dichotomy between the two different places. So I grew up in a place where, you know, culturally everybody behaved a certain way. So I'd go back to the inner city, and, you know, people would say, wow, you're trying to be white, for example. Go back to the other place, and people say you're trying to be this or that.
Right.
I guess the point I think that people should probably think about is that black or white, I think, in my opinion, after seeing it for a lot of years, is probably more cultural than it is anything else. Because, you know, people, there's just, when you live in a certain place, you live in Australia, that's how you're going to speak. You're not going to try to be Australian. That's just, you know, you're in Rome and you do as the Romans do.
Yeah.
You know, so I think it's far more of her identifying with just the cultural aspect of the way she lives her everyday life and what she identifies with. So
would you say of yourself, I'm assuming that you're a person who, if somebody just saw you on the street, would say, this guy's a black guy, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, and yet you're speaking in what some might describe as white English, and I realize this is really, really a touchy area. I don't want to assume anything. Talk to me about this, Carrie. What led you to that decision or to that culture? Is that because that's where you went to school with white folks?
That's a beautiful question. It wasn't really, so think about this, you know, you're 12 years old and, you know, your parents say grew up more of in a sort of a rural area, inner city area.
Right.
You know, they're, you know, it's in the 70s. They say, okay, I want my kids to, you know, maybe, I want them to go to college and do some different things. So, you know, they branch out, they go do some different things. And it wasn't a decision. You know, you're going to school and everybody's talking like I'm talking now.
Right.
So it's, you know, you're not going to, you're just sort of trying to fit in, right? You're just going to be like the other guy. If you're trying to do some other thing, I mean, you know, kids that go to junior high school are trying to fit in and trying to be like the other kid.
Right.
You don't, we know what happens, right?
Right. Well, one of the things I noticed with a black friend of mine is that when he's around white folks, he talks like you're talking to me right now. But if we're walking down the street, we run into some black folks. Suddenly, he's talking differently, and it's almost like he's bicultural.
Well, I mean, that's what it is. I mean, so as you're going along, that's what I think is really great about the debate that she's bringing up, which is that, you know, we get caught up in all these monikers and labels. So we say there's the race for this and a race for that. My kids, for example, are part African-American, part German, part Norwegian, and everything else. So what happens? So when you look at those kids and you say you're this or you're that, I mean, that's the reality of that is if you move forward, you know, 50 years, do we put a new moniker on that?
Right.
I mean, do we start to think that the race is just the human race? I mean, at what point do we start to not, you know, get caught up in these old norms that are created by some of the things you talk about, you know, institutional norms that separate people, you know, two-fifths of this or, you know, whatever the case may be. When do we start saying that people are...
Go ahead.
When do we start recognizing people as the human race with all these different little subcultures that behave in different ways based on whatever the, you know, whatever those backgrounds are? You know, I live in Orange County. You know, there's you know, communities. What I noticed is that black people or white people, you know, African-American or people of more European descent or wherever the case may be, there's an assimilation between both. You mentioned that your friend might see somebody and start talking more black. well, I've been involved in sports all my life too. So yes, I mean, you kind of go back and forth. And what you see in some areas of the country is that you'll see like a mixture of where, you know, people will kind of, you know, not speak, you know, Ibanez or, you know, in air quotes, white. It's a sort of a combination, like a hybrid of those two things. And they don't think about it as one thing or the other. That's just what it becomes, right?
Well, it's kind of a natural human tendency. I mean, Louise and I spent 2 weeks in Ireland, and by the end of those 2 weeks, I had a fairly faint but noticeable Irish accent, and it wasn't like I was trying to fit in. I mean, it's just I was so used to hearing people talk that way that I was picking it up. Just a little bit, but I mean, you know, it's kind of cultural immersion.
Sure, and that's what happens. I mean, that's really what happens, because you can break down how people say, you know, pool or school or, you know, all these different things, and when you're around it, it's almost like, you know, for a comfort level, sometimes, you know, if you're better at assimilating, you might kind of like, I mean, throughout my life, I might assimilate and change my language a little bit to make somebody else feel more comfortable.
Right.
Because I've been in a situation where people, you know, I'm talking to them and they speak more kind of an Ebonic thing, or I have family members that do that.
Yeah.
You sort of go back and forth, and it's more of a comfort thing, but it's just two white subcultures, right? I mean,
yeah. Yeah. Well, it's like what Kareem Abdul-Jabbar said. We're all members of the human race, and then we've got these cultures within that human race. Given the idea that, you know, race is a social construct. Kerry, thank you. I'm learning every day, and you're part of my learning. Thank you. Great talking with you. And thanks for listening to SiriusXM. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Anything goes summer here, and Mayor Adam O'Neill will be with us at the top of the hour. Stick around for that, too. Welcome back. George in Buford, South Carolina, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, George, what's up?
Oh, Tom, I guess I wanted to talk about Rachel. And she brought me back to the 60s when the nation or the government required airlines to hire black pilots.
Right.
I was one of the first six.
Oh, really?
And then that was an interesting thing that happened after that. Because there was, I guess, a percentage or quota that was required, suddenly I found many young white people saying they were black to obtain those jobs.
Really?
So they applied to the airlines as black. I don't think many of them were successful, but they did give that an effort.
Yeah.
So immediately I thought maybe Rachel had opportunities as black that she wouldn't have as white. But now I think it's a completely different thing. And I years ago read a book that explained a whole lot about all the questions you're asking.
Uh-huh.
It's called The ISIS Papers. That's ISIS Papers.
Mm-hmm.
The Keys to the Colors. And it's by Dr. Francis Cress Welsing.
Can you summarize it in a minute and a half?
Huh?
Can you summarize it in the minute and a half before we hit the break?
And, I'm about through with this explains, the book itself explains a whole lot of things about so many things I've heard you asking or saying that you don't understand. And all I wanted to do was let you know about this book, and maybe it would help you understand what is going on.
Well, can you tell me something that you learned from the book that I should know?
Well, it's about color and her basic probing and analysis of the symbols that oppress African-Americans and all peoples of color.
Mm-hmm.
Insights on such topics as relationships between black children and their parents, the threats to black Americans, and the crisis in black and female relationships, unraveling of network of fears embedded in such European symbols and practices as ball games, money, gold, guns, and even the white Christ figure.
Right. Okay. I got it. George, thank you very much. Thanks for calling and sharing your story with us, and good on you for being one of the first African-American pilots in the United States. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back, 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Lowell in Salem, Oregon. Hey, Lowell, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to let you know about the Donald's statement when he made in front of Fox News.
Oh, did you watch it?
I watched the whole thing, and he said, "I'm a free trader."
Oh, you're kidding. So he's changed his position.
Yeah, he's changed his position. So I think he's like one of those guys you were talking about that fundraises with a super PAC just to keep the money.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he doesn't need the money. I think he's doing this more for ego than for cash. But who knows? I mean, sometimes some rich people are rich because they're OCD about money and any little bit they can get, they get as much as they can. But that's.
Yeah, but he said we need to negotiate the free trade agreement like a businessman, or, you know, however,
yeah.
You know, his New Jersey, fake New Jersey accent.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go. Okay. Thank you, Lowell. Thanks for that piece of information. I appreciate it. So there goes my support for Donald Trump. Alex in Cambridge, New York. Hey, Alex, what's up?
Alex, what's up? Hey, Tom. I had a question about trade. if we significantly raise tariffs, as you suggest, with protectionist policies, as we did with Smoot-Hawley, could that result in a halt in global trade and other countries in retaliation would do the same?
To some extent, yes. But let me correct your Smoot-Hawley reference. Smoot-Hawley was a very slight. Before Smoot-Hawley, as I recall, and it's been some years since I read this, and I wrote about this in my book, Rebooting the American Dream. Before Smoot-Hawley, from basically the George Washington administration until 1929 or 1930, yeah, Herbert Hoover was the guy who pushed this through. The tariff on imported goods into the United States averaged around 30%, 30, 31, 32%. And Smoot-Hawley kicked it up by about a point and a half. And there are people running around, you know, like up to 33%. And then after World War II, it went back down again by about a point and a half, back down to around 30%. And it stayed there basically until the Reagan administration. And it's now on average around 2%. And the consequence of Smoot-Hawley was pretty insignificant. Trade was less than 2% of American GDP at the time that Smoot-Hawley was passed. There was a slight decrease in trade. It was a couple tenths of a percent, but it was Smoot-Hawley did not prolong the Great Depression, did not affect the Great Depression. The reason why international trade collapsed, and Smoot-Hawley was arguably an effort to actually increase our advantage with trade, the reason it crashed was because the entire world was in the Great Depression. And so what would happen if we were to go back to tariffs the way they were before the Reagan administration, where the average tariff was 30%, is that most of our manufacturing would come back to the United States rather quickly, and there'd be, unemployment would drop radically, wages would go up, the economy would be massively stimulated. And if you want the proof of this, look at China. 30 years ago, China was a third world nation with dirt streets. And I mean, I lived there in November of 1986 in Beijing and for a little less than a month. And it was the third world, you know. And now China is the most developed country in the world. They just finished a 300 mile an hour high speed train that is the equivalent of running from Chicago to New York. And you can make the trip in like, you know, half a day or something like that. I mean, they are so far ahead of us. Why? Because they maintain tariffs. They don't call them tariffs, but they maintain trade obstruction, essentially. It's very hard for American products to be sold in China. On the other hand, we lowered our defenses, and we allow them to sell pretty much anything they want to us at an average tariff of around 1 or 2%. So if that tariff went up, we would start, you know, we would reverse that process. We basically shipped all our manufacturing to China. China became the richest country in the world. Their economy just surpassed ours about 6 months ago. And you know, if we were to, in my opinion, if we were to go back to the rules that George Washington and Alexander Hamilton worked out that made this country great, that Abraham Lincoln supported, that politicians of both parties supported right up until the 1980s, when this bizarre idea of doing away with tariffs and having free trade, you know, which is only benefits transnational corporations, came along, you would see those, you know, America once it began being prosperous, in my opinion. So, Alex, thanks a lot for the call. TJ in Lithonia, Georgia. Hey, TJ, what's up? TJ? Okay, let's try Dan in Lehigh Acres, Florida. Hey, Dan, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. How you doing?
Good. What's on your mind?
This is just more of a general statement about this Rachel mess. I think it's very important for us to separate what she's done from the mistakes that she's made. There's been plenty of great thinkers throughout time who have made horrible mistakes. I'm a philosophy student. Martin Heidegger was a notorious Nazi, but he is one of the most influential thinkers in the past few centuries. So it's very important to separate what somebody has done from what they stand for and whatnot. And I just want to say I appreciate you talking about TPP and that whole mess.
Yeah.
Because I think that's much more newsworthy than how somebody identifies themselves.
Yeah. Time? Okay, great. Thank you very much, Don. I appreciate that. Let's see here. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's up? Got a minute to the break.
I just wanted to, you know, talk about white privilege. I do think, you know, as you laid it out, that pecking order, I mean, it's rather dismal, but I think we could get past that if we really wanted to. I think that really we are what we think and we are what our culture, you know, tells us, I think, because we're very communitarian kinds of people. That's how we get our sense of self.
Right.
And I think that historically, you know, you have the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant male, and then you have a lot of other little subgroups, like Corky was talking about the Irish. I come from, you know, somewhat of an Irish background. And I think that when people, you know, suffer under another group of people, not to the extent that African Americans suffer or American Indians, which is, you know, just, you know, absolute genocide and just being ground into the dirt. But, you know, we all suffer this, and that psychological damage is actually inculturated into a way of life, and it's transmitted to the next generation. And I've seen it in my own family. My one side of the family is very WASPy. I had a cousin that was the Burl Crane guy, you know. I mean, he had the...
Yeah. John, I got to wrap it up, but yeah, I think you're onto something there. Thank you very much for the call. We'll be back with Meryl O'Neill. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and I'm pleased to have in the studio with me, and you'll be able to see him in just a second as our TriCaster reboots, if you're watching, Mayor Adam O'Neill, the Republican mayor of Belhaven, North Carolina, and a friend of his, Bob Zellner, who is the author of The Wrong Side of Murder Creek, a white Southerner in the freedom struggle. He was with SNCC and the NAACP, and they have walked together over 300 miles to Washington, D.C., and gentlemen, welcome to both of you.
Great to be with you again.
And, welcome back, Mayor. And so, Mayor Adam O'Neill, you're the Republican mayor of Belhaven, North Carolina. We've talked before about this, but not everybody who's watching or listening right now might have heard that conversation. So just give me a snapshot of what happened to Belhaven and why you walked all the way from North Carolina to Washington, D.C.
Well, our first walk had to do with Vidant Health coming to our town, a big conglomerate, nonprofit, came to our community and took over our hospital, promised to maintain and strengthen it and to increase services. when the whole time they knew they were going to close our hospital.
Right.
And then they closed our hospital in a year that they, Vidant Health, a nonprofit, made $109 million.
Jeez.
And also they now have about $700 million in reserves, and they're closing critical access hospitals and actually the first Hill Burton hospital in the country.
Hmm.
So anyway, that was the walk July of last year, which Bob walked every step with me. This year, in February, I was talking at a policy summit with the National Rural Health Association, and I was researching for my speech, and I saw where there were 283 rural hospitals looking at closure this year, which blew my mind. Because I've seen in Belhaven what happens when a hospital closes, the economic devastation, but also the needless loss of lives. So I told the people at the function that during my speech, if somebody would walk with me, I'd do another walk to D.C. So that's what we did. We had over 20 states participate, and we had a terrific event, a rally yesterday. And what our goal was to get some national attention and start some national debate about these rural hospitals.
Right.
And I think we did that without a doubt. And number two, we wanted to see if we get some legislation started to take care and save these rural hospitals. And I think we may have done that as well.
So, and if I understand this correctly, you've got really two problems with these rural hospitals. One is basically since I don't want to make this sound too partisan, you're a Republican, I'm, but, you know, since Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Act in 1982, mergers and acquisitions have just exploded across this country, and you get these big companies that are acting like parasites. I mean, they're or whatever, monsters, big fish eating small fish, and so that's happening. And then on top of that, in those states where Medicaid has not been expanded, those hospitals are more vulnerable because they're just running at a huge loss because the Medicaid is not paying the bill of the poor people.
Well, the mergers that are going on, it's really not. You're not able to use the same business principles with healthcare as you do with hardware stores,
right?
Because it's something that's needed. It's a public good, and you have a situation where sometimes these healthcare conglomerates like Vidant Health take a business philosophy or try to do economies of scale and forget that when they close a hospital, people die. See, our hospital didn't close because it could never make money. I had three business plans done showing the hospital could succeed. They closed our hospital because they wanted to force patients to another hospital, which was losing a bunch of money,
which
they didn't
owned.
Know how to fix, which they owned. And the thing that really got us fired up is that they came in, took over our hospital, and the executives knew they were going to close it when they took it over and totally lied to our community. So that's why we really got fired up. These 283 hospitals, 80% of them are in states that haven't accepted Medicaid expansion. 20% are in states that have accepted Medicaid expansion. So you've got the Medicaid expansion, sequester. That's affected some of the reimbursements. That's got to be dealt with. And then you've got these conglomerates coming in and dealing with and eating up small hospitals.
Yeah.
Medicaid expansion in North Carolina is $3.7 billion that we're turning away right now.
Wow.
Now, if you take $3.7 billion out of the health care system in North Carolina, do you think that would have an effect on our state?
Or if you put it in, the effect would be stimulative.
Exactly.
In addition to saving lives. I mean, when your hospital closed, it wasn't just that the guy who had the farm accident and bled out because he couldn't get to a hospital fast enough, or the woman with a heart attack. You've told us
exactly.
These stories. It's not just that. There were probably hundreds of people who worked there who are now out of work.
Right.
And now they're on the public dole, as it were, when they should be earning an income.
Exactly.
So, Bob Zellner, the author of The Wrong Side of Murder Creek, A White Southerner in the Freedom Struggle. You were with SNCC. You were with the NAACP. You're marching with the mayor. Why?
I'm marching with the mayor, Tom, because something that started as a local story is now a national story with 283 hospitals. But the great story here is a progressive story, because a lot of the advances that the 1% have made and the extreme right has been to get people to vote against their own economic interest.
Yeah.
And Reverend Barber and the North Carolina Moral Movement has shown that we can cross partisan lines, race lines, sex lines, all of these things. We can have a fusion politics that makes people vote for the moral thing.
Right.
And so that's what this is about. A civil rights worker and a conservative GOP mayor walking together 2 years 283 miles for 283 hospitals. That's the story right now. And this is going to go national. It's a model of grassroots organizing that the national press does not want to admit. We've had over 1,000 people arrested in North Carolina, and we had a demonstration of 80 to 100,000 people at the legislature. Wasn't covered by the national news.
Whoa, you're kidding.
I'm not kidding, and it's a very hidden story that they will not cover. And we're going to insist that they cover it because it's national news.
Yeah, but it's all about corporate America.
Yes, absolutely. And, they're very powerful.
Yeah, and this is the problem. For people who want to do something or help somehow, the hashtag that I've got written down here is Save Our Hospital. SaveOurHospital.com is the website. Are there
others? Actually, our website, identify with the walk, is thewalk, T-H-E-W-A-L-K, N-C-T-O-D-C.com.
Right.
Thewalk, N-C-T-O-D-C.com.
Right.
So you can go in there and learn more about what we're doing.
So,
but I think what's important with Bob being here today is showing America that you can find issues where conservatives, liberals can work together, where all of us can work together, no matter what our politics are.
Right.
And health care has to be one of those areas.
Right. And Bob, just a little side note here. You were with SNCC back in the 1960s, same time that Bernie Sanders was a SNCC organizer. What took you into that as a white guy, if you don't mind my asking?
Well, I heard some of the early discussion, and I've always identified as white, but I have always been involved in the movement. I got involved with Dr. King and Rosa Parks when I was a college student in Montgomery, Alabama, over 50 years ago.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm involved with Reverend Barber now. And the mayor and I were both with Bernie Sanders in Selma at this past 50th anniversary of the Bloody Sunday March.
Right.
So this is really pulling people together across the partisan lines, and it's going to be a new paradigm for organizing in America. We're not a leaderless movement. We have leaders, local leaders, and this grassroots thing that's happening in North Carolina is going to go national.
Right, and this is great and important stuff. Once again, Mayor O'Neill, last moment here. The website people should go to, what they can do.
TheWalkNCToDC.com. You can go on the website. You can help us out with donations. We've still got expenses we're paying from the walk.
Right.
But more importantly, you can reach out to your congressmen, to your senators, your House members and your senators, and let them know that rural hospitals are important, because rural hospitals serve our veterans. 30 to 40% of veterans live in rural areas. Our children live out there. Our friends and family live out there. It's not okay under any circumstance to close 283 rural hospitals.
I absolutely agree. Mayor Adam O'Neill, Bob Zellner, you guys are heroes. Thank you so much for dropping by today. Great
to see
you.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you. And we'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Back with your calls on Anything Goes Summer right after this. Welcome back, 15 minutes past the hour. And Rose in College Station, Texas. Hey, Rose, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind?
Yes, I'm a first-time caller, and I heard you talk about Obama not knowing or possibly being in a bubble and not really knowing what the facts are about TPP, but I discount that because for 6 years in secret, they worked on TPP, and you can't tell me Obama is no dummy. He knew exactly what he was doing. And to me, it all boils down to cash. And so that's my final conclusion.
So you think that either he's doing this in exchange for, back in the day, the money to become president, or he's doing it for the promise of future income, basically?
Well, for the beginning, I think his teachers were Clinton and Bush. And Bush even came to the White House, and he was in there for hours. So I think it's all planned. It's just like secret TPP. It's all worked out. You don't know what those people are saying in the White House. We don't know what TPP is. And what has he done? He's created a law that he tells his Congress, you are not to tell the public. Oh, you can tell them after we pass it. Now, what kind of a president would do that? Is that democratic? Absolutely not. and that fellow you were just talking to, Bob, God made a good man there.
Yeah, I agree.
Very good man.
Yeah.
So it's just that I feel you're being too soft on Obama, and you claim I really don't know.
Well, I really don't know, and I'm willing to consider the possibility that he's just getting terrible advice, and that Bill Clinton got terrible advice, and that these guys can be very convincing, and they've got a lot of money, and they look like they're really smart. Well, they are really smart.
They are really smart, and I don't think if you are greedy, you will not stop being greedy until you get more and more.
But see, I don't see Obama as greedy. I mean, when he came out of law school, he could have made a fortune. He was like at the top of the pile. You know, he could have become a corporate lawyer, and he'd be a multimillionaire by now. And instead, he decided to become a community organizer. That's not the kind of behavior that you see out of a person who's in it for the money.
Okay, that in itself is true. But he's now been tainted by the power that he has. Power corrupts.
Well, I think power, you know, in this case, I think power brings with it a bubble. I mean, this is one of the things that I've heard from a number of people in this town, both elected officials and people that I know in the news media. It's been such an education living in Washington, D.C. these last 5 years, that people like the president, and not just this president, but pretty much every president, you know, going back to, you know, probably the Eisenhower days that there's so much happening. There's so much going on that the president is responsible for that he has to delegate things out to individuals in his cabinet and on his staff, and he has to rely on those people and doesn't have the time or ability to do all that research himself. And if they come and say, hey, you know, I mean, one of Obama's campaign promises was that he was going to renegotiate NAFTA. And now basically what he's saying is this TPP is the beginning of the renegotiation of NAFTA. And we all thought he meant blow it up and make it go away. But I don't know. Rose, I'm not ready to go totally cynical on Obama, although I know my friend Mike Papantonio would probably strongly disagree with that. We'll see where it goes. Hey, Rose, thank you for the call. We'll be back. I'm telling you, Mayor Adam O'Neill, the Republican, who, by the way, when he was here last in February, I gave him a copy of my book, The Crash of 2016, and he was just telling me off the air, I'm sure he wouldn't mind my sharing this with you. He said, other than the last 30 pages, where I get kind of partisan, he said, boy, what a great history. He liked the book. So that was a great honor to me, you know, to have a conservative Republican elected official say, I read your book. And this, you know. And so I gave him a copy of Rebooting the American Dream, which is the book that Bernie wrote a letter to every member of the U.S. Senate, all 99 others, saying, you have to read this book, and we hand-delivered the books to them. So we'll see what the mayor thinks about that book. Anyhow, a lot going on, a lot on our plates. If anything goes, summer. I've brought up a bunch of issues, and more will come up as we continue through these hours, but let's pick up some phone calls. Paul in Woodinville, Washington, listening on KBCS. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I don't know if you may have seen or heard of the remarks of Republican Congressman Crescent Hardy, 4th District of Nevada, who said that disabled people are a drain on society.
Oh, no.
The quote is this: my children will not be a drain on society like disabled children. This is the quote that I've seen. Now, I do my investigative journalism as best as I can, so I called his office in Nevada yesterday afternoon, and lo and behold, he answered the phone.
Huh.
He identified himself. I said, you're the representative? He said, yes. What can I do for you? I said, I want to ask you about your remark that you said that disabled people are a drain on society. He said, I don't think I said that. He's got kind of a southern accent. I don't know if that's Nevada. But
yeah.
I said, well, you're quoted as saying that your children will not be a drain on society like disabled children. He said, well, I didn't mean that. I said, that's the quote. You didn't say those words? He said, well, you can do anything with a tape. And I said, well, what did you mean? He said, I meant that people should take care of themselves. I said, disabled children should take care of themselves? How? He said, no, I mean that their parents shouldn't rely on the government. But I said, well, disabilities can be expensive. I mean, maybe they should have been abortions. I said, but the problem is you didn't propose any solution. I mean, I understand your observation. Do you have a solution? He was silent, so I suggested that maybe we should make lunch meat out of them and feed them to the non-disabled kids at school.
Soylent Green.
Yeah.
And what did he say?
Thomas Swift's modest proposal, remember?
Right, right.
What did he say? He said, I don't want to talk to you anymore. And I said, all right, thank you for representing the Republican Party so eloquently.
Yeah, amazing.
So, Tom, I was born a disabled child. In fact, now I'm a disabled adult, and I am a drain on society. So I'm thinking about having myself chopped up into barbecue meat for this summer, you know, ribs, chops, pulled Paul butt, you know.
Yeah.
Be pretty good, and I won't be a drain on society anymore.
I would prefer that you just out this guy as a crazy and continue with your life, Paul. We need you.
Well, you know, that's what needs to be done. That's why I'm letting that. This is, you know, I have to say, I can empathize with gay, lesbian, you know, LGBTQ people because this is what you get. This is what you get for you become subhuman, subhumanized, and you're a drain on society. And, yeah, exactly. And then I got the impression that he thought my suggestion of making lunch meat out of disabled children was repugnant and disgusting. But, you know, why make a remark like that? What is that? What?
Right.
Who wins with that remark?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if it was before or after Hitler went for the Jews, but he also, you know, went for disabled people. I mean, that was the eugenics. Well, I mean, eugenics actually started in the UK and the United States, and we did it. They started in the UK, and we were doing it more aggressively than the UK. And Hitler was taking our eugenics posters, and, you know, in other words, let's weed out the gene pool here. Let's only let the strong reproduce.
Buck versus Bell, 1927, when Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote, three generations of imbeciles are enough.
Right, right, in support of eugenics.
One of his more eloquent remarks.
Right, in support of eugenics. It's amazing. Paul, thank you for sharing that with us.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking with you, as always. Gary in Lithonia, Georgia. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I love your show.
Thank you.
I want to have some thoughts on the lady that claimed to be black.
Yeah, Rachel.
And
Rachel Dolezal. Shawl.
It's like the movie Dances with Wolves, where he was isolated, and he got immersed into the Indian society, and then became an Indian. So for those who say she has no part or no she doesn't own any part of the black experience, I would say to them. Well, somebody changed their religion to Judaism. Would they say they have no part of the Jewish experience? I say not. You see, race, religion, they are just social constructs that man created.
Right.
The black experience is a humanity experience. We are all human beings. We all have a part of that and an own part of that. So I think she has a heavy right to describe herself as how she feels.
Yeah. You know, this is interesting because Louise mentioned this to me this morning when we were talking about this. She said, you know, you should share with people from Jefferson's diary about the white Indians. And Jefferson in his personal diaries back when, in, you know, 10 years ago when I was reading them, he was talking about the fact that so many white settlers were abandoning the white communities and going to live with the Native Americans, because they found the lifestyle so much more pleasant. You know, the Native Americans, it was more peaceful. There was less disease. They were healthier. It was a culture that was inclusive rather than exclusive. It was not hierarchical. And there was a real problem that they were having in the 1770s and the 100 years before that. of white folks going off to live with Native Americans and basically calling themselves Indians. As you said, that kind of the dances with wolf syndrome. Gary, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
So, a lot going on. Oh, this is interesting. Paul wants to disagree with me about the TPP. We'll have that conversation after the break. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. People wondering why President Obama would push this Trans-Pacific Partnership. By the way, the vote is happening as we speak on House Resolution 315, which is the attachment to the intelligence bill, which will allow John Boehner and Mitch McConnell and the president to have until July 30th to try to shove fast track down our throats. And, you know, more time for the lobbyists and more time for the big transnational corporations and foreign governments to work their magic on our members of Congress. And Larry Schultz tweeted out a quote from Robert Reich. Now, Robert Reich is a solid guy. He was probably the most progressive member of Bill Clinton's cabinet. He was the Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration. He is a professor of, I believe, economics at the University of California, I think at Berkeley. And he posted this on Facebook, and I just want to share it intact, because this is what this member of Congress, and I'm not giving you his name, not because it's some giant secret, but at the time I should have said, do you mind if I share this with your name on the air? Because I'm sure he would, if he was sitting here, he would just tell you. But I ran across a member of Congress over the weekend. He's a member of the House Progressive Caucus. And, you know, we sat together and had a drink and talked for a while. And I said, you know, why is Obama supporting this? You know, was he bribed? Is he being threatened? And he said, I think it's Michael Froman. I think it's, you know, he's getting bad advice from his trade advisor. And I was like, that's really, you know, hard to believe. And he says, you don't understand what a bubble presidents live in. He said, it's, you know, he said, members of Congress live in a bubble too, but we at least get back to our districts every couple weekends. And you know, the Republicans tend not to do town hall meetings, but the Democrats all do. And you find out what's going on and how people think. And, you know, so anyhow, here's what Robert Reich wrote. Why has President Obama been willing to spend so much political capital on the Trans-Pacific Partnership? ? I have a guess. It begins with Michael Froman, the United States trade representative who's been in charge of this debacle. Froman went to Harvard Law School with Obama. But that's not the only important connection. In the Clinton administration, Froman was chief of staff to Bob Rubin when Rubin was Secretary of the Treasury. Rubin, you may recall, was the guy who convinced Clinton to pass NAFTA to kill the Glass-Steagall Act and to not regulate financial derivatives. Immediately after the Clinton administration, Froman accompanied Rubin to Citigroup, where Rubin ran the bank's executive committee while Froman became president and chief executive officer of Citi Insurance and head of the emerging market strategy. Froman remained at Citigroup until Obama tapped him to be U.S. trade representative. And parenthetically, Froman did well at the bank, receiving more than $7.4 million from January 2008 to 2009 alone, close parentheses. Not incidentally, Froman was the person who first introduced Obama to Rubin. When it comes to understanding influence in Washington, Robert Reich writes, following the people is almost as important as following the money, and sometimes they're the same thing. So I guess, you know, if I had a message to President Obama, it would be stop listening to Michael Froman and Robert Rubin. These guys are, you know, they know what the banks want, but they apparently have very little interest in what the people want, at least as far as I can tell. Harry in Providence, Rhode Island. Hey, Harry, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm a minister from Providence, Rhode Island, and I'm calling because our state has a tremendous chance to legalize marijuana through the legislature. Mm-hmm. Actually, more than two-thirds of the legislators support the bill. So the key to passage is for Rhode Islanders to call the Speaker of the House and ask Speaker Mattiello to allow a vote. His number is quite simple, 222-2466.
And Rhode Island is all one area code, so if you live in Rhode Island, you know what it is?
Exactly.
Okay. Okay.
And then, as to whether it should pass, I really think it should be treated the same way as alcohol in the Bible, particularly wine. You'll recall Jesus made at least 90 gallons of water into wine for a wedding banquet. And that, of course, is a recreational drug, too.
Right.
And on the other hand, the Bible suggests that no one should become a drunkard, and I'd say the same applies to becoming a pothead.
Right, right. In other words, don't abuse your recreational drugs. Okay, Harry, good. What was the phone number again for the speaker for our listeners in Rhode Island?
222-2466.
And his name is?
Speaker Mattiello, and thank you so much, Tom.
You're welcome, Harry. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for your activism. Stephanie in Kankakee, Illinois. Am I saying that right, Stephanie?
You know, it's Kankakee.
Kankakee.
You listen to, the city of New Orleans. That's one of the cities they pull out of. Kankakee, Illinois.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, Kankakee is about 60 miles south of Chicago, straight south, down 57.
Mm-hmm.
We have two hospitals. And we're basically rural. There's mostly farmland out here. There's three cities, but they're under 100,000 people, or just around there. But anyway, south of us, you have to go another hour to get to another small hospital, and then from there you got to go all the way to Champaign, which is a two-hour drive. Now, they were talking to our hospitals. One of them is talking to possibly closing, but people fought and they kept it open. What they did was they closed the children's wards in both hospitals. So if any children have any, there's no pediatrics wards in either hospital we have. They have to go way up 60, 70 miles into Chicago, way into the city, to the children's hospital up there if they have an illness. And their pediatricians down here, but there's no wards for children if they get sick. So if anyone's children get sick, they got to drive all the way 60 miles to Chicago to put them in the hospital to see them.
Wow.
So we're fighting, and Bruce Rauner, our governor, is also trying to close all the mental health hospitals in the city, in the state, and put everyone in some type of group homes. Now, I worked in mental health hospitals with children and adults.
Mm.
There are some clients who can never live in a community. They
sure.
just can't.
Sure.
For many reasons. Some of them are violent or whatever. So I don't know what's going to happen. And when they close these hospitals, we're talking thousands of jobs, thousands of jobs. And so when he was questioned, it's okay, we save money closing these clinics, then we lose thousands of jobs and people on unemployment. He tells us the same thing he tells us when he wants to take 50% of the funding from the cities. People got to figure out how to function without the government. That's what his goal is, for us to figure out how to function without any government help. And if we can't figure it out, then we're just on our own. So rural health care is really being hit hard by Republicans.
Yeah.
And even in this blue state. And believe me, our Democratic legislators fighting him tooth and nail. The government is about to shut down July 15th because we can't get anything done. He's already cut off energy assistance. He's cut off funds to women who need help with child care. So so we're really fighting hard, and, you know, it's sad. But I don't know what's going to happen in the future to our young people.
Yeah.
Yeah. They got to deal with governors like Warner down here.
Yeah, it's amazing stuff, Stephanie. And this is what happens when something as, I mean, the Declaration of Independence talks about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. How can you have life if you don't have access to medical care? This should not be an opportunity for profit. This should be the public good, and it should, you know, in my opinion, it should all be being paid for by the government. Stephanie, thank you for the call. Thanks for the heads up on that. Paul in South Lyon, Michigan. Hey, Paul, it says here you disagree with me about the TPP.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. I agree with you that if Republicans didn't have a stranglehold on Congress, we should have appropriate tariffs. But that's not possible. So people like Obama and Clinton, who understand economics and trade, so they support TPP, they don't do personal attacks on you and Bernie Sanders and others who don't understand TPP. So I think it's wrong for you to question their motives. If you're against TPP increasing exports and creating jobs, then be honest and stick to the facts. And also,
I don't believe, Paul, first of all, I don't believe that the TPP will increase exports and create jobs. I think it's going to have the opposite effect. Every trade agreement in the past has had the opposite effect, number one. And number two, the president actually questioned, you talk about ad hominem attacks, the president actually questioned Elizabeth Warren. He went after her with an ad hominem attack on this issue.
Yeah. After she went after him for months.
Not ad hominem.
Finally pointed out that she was being dishonest, which she was.
No, she was not.
Yes, with all this talk about, oh, it's so super secret, TPP.
Well, it is super secret.
All things are negotiated. All international agreements are negotiated in secret. Of course it's secret.
Why can it not be? So I'm assuming that you also support Fast Track.
Absolutely.
You know, whenever you call Paul, I'm thinking this. Paul is the corporate wing of the Democratic Party.
No, Tom. You are the union wing of the country. Apparently, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm definitely the Bernie Sanders wing of the Democratic Party.
He's controlled by unions. Yeah, you know, there are union lobbyists.
But unions are democracies.
Yeah. Okay. Well, union lobbyists are better than corporate lobbyists, but they're not. They still have their own special interest to look after. They don't.
Right. The special interest is the workers. I'm standing with the workers. Not the workers of the United States, not the workers of Vietnam who have a minimum wage of 56 cents an hour.
That's already true. TPP will not stop that either way, whether it goes through or not. It won't change that a bit. That's another ridiculous scare tactic.
No, we need to undo all of them. We need to not do TPP and undo CAFTA and NAFTA and SHAFTA and all of them, in my opinion. Paul, thank you for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of your calls and the Talk Radio News Service right after this. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. And Jesse, watching Free Speech TV in Miami, Florida. Hey, Jesse, what's on your mind?
Hey, hi, Tom. Hey, Malcolm X got to be smiling somewhere. He gave a speech about black people being different by people working in the house of the white man and people working in the field.
Right.
I would say Malcolm is smiling now because this lady Rachel and Obama being president, a lot of white people starting to realize that they are the house servants.
Hmm.
And the people of the world have been the field servants. So the system, the capitalism, for better or worse, is on its last legs, and everybody see it for what it is.
Yeah.
To make the point stronger, Ferguson, when the Justice Department came down with the report about how the government was living off the tickets of the black community, okay, it's all true. Now, what are all these government people, white middle-class people, going to do once it becomes, you know, they can't ticket the people no more? They find out it's oppression. So you just look at the bigger picture on this at the world. Greece.
Yeah.
All the government there can't pay, you know, what they was doing, you know, when so-called, they call oppress the system economically. So I think you see what I mean, but let me get this in real quick. Thank you very much for talking about public banking trying to be prohibited in this so-called agreement.
Right.
If they stop us from trying to vote with our money, what would be the critical mass for violence? I'll leave it at that. Thank you very much, Tom.
Thank you, Jesse. That's the freaky question. Freaky is the wrong word. That's the frightening question. And let's hope it never gets to anything like that. Although I think, you know, in some ways, when you see the riots in Baltimore and the activity in Ferguson, that's what you're seeing. It is sliding into violence. Steve in Phoenix. Hey, Steve, what's up? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Good morning to you. Just wanted to say you're right about the TSA. Just going through the magnetometer, we got comped, both me and the wife, TSA upgrades last week coming out of Wisconsin, and that's all we had to do, so it was great.
Well, that's great. So you got the pre. Yeah.
You betcha. I want to apply for it and get it, hopefully.
Yeah.
Anyways, I was watching corporate TV last night, And an unnamed host was stating that Hillary's stance on the trade deal should be to kind of sit and wait, just like her husband Bill was. And that was the correct way to go. And, you know, he mentioned that Ross Perot said the deal would be horrible and that H.W. Bush said it would be great, but Bill's was the correct position. But he failed to mention, this host failed to mention that NAFTA is a disaster. It
right.
was a disaster.
Right.
And then he also moved on to, this host said, that Bernie wants to redistribute wealth. And he also made a reference to Bernie as being kind of like a one-night stand type candidate or candidate or something to that effect. And then
yeah.
and in the end, you'll go to the Hillary type candidate. I forget exactly how it was said.
Yeah, people
but
like
anyways,
like having an affair with Bernie, but they're going to end up married to Hillary, or words to that effect. I don't know who you're talking about. I didn't see that show, but that's sad to hear that that's what's going on network television. Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. Ten minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, and find out what's going on in the world. Talk Radio News, of course, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. Robert Bobnay, Congressman, how are you?
I'm good, Tom. How are you?
I'm fine. I should add also Bob Ney is the author of the brilliant book Sideswiped, which if you have not read, you must. Back to you, Bob. What's going on in the world?
Well, Tom, you were just talking about marriage of one and courting the other when you were talking about Senator Sanders and Hillary Clinton. Well, when you look at Nancy Pelosi and the vote on the trade bill, it's not a divorce of the president, and a lot of things are sinking in today, frankly, on Capitol Hill, you know, because the mainstream media tried to make it an issue that this was going to sink and doom the Democratic side of the aisle, and it's actually not going to do that of what happened with Nancy Pelosi and then the unions saying, look, you know, don't put the displaced worker money in there. The reason I mention that, if you look at the actual polling, now this is very interesting, and this is going to shock some people, I think. These are legitimate polls. Two-thirds of Americans, Democrat and Republicans alike, oppose trade agreements that exchange the family wage job for allegedly cheaper consumer goods when they're posed that question. And it goes on further to say that an additional two polls find that free trade deals trouble, guess what, Republican rank and file more than the Democratic side, actually.
Hmm.
So if you look at the Pennsylvania delegation, which, you know, cast some votes, 10 of the 12 Republicans, Congressman Fitzpatrick in the Bucks County area, for example, and I've been up there, so I'm familiar with it. 10 of those 12 Republicans are in a bit of jeopardy with Pennsylvania's climate of manufacturing job losses. And when you look at all of this, in actual reality, this trade bill is now in even deeper trouble because Speaker Boehner didn't have the votes to reignite it.
Right.
So they're going to have a vote at the end of July.
Right, because they just this thing just passed this apparently this extension to July 30th.
Right.
I'm guessing it'll actually happen probably the weekend of July 4th when everything drops into the memory hole.
Exactly, but in all reality, that gives time for this actually to fester in a worse way for Speaker Boehner because people are going to go home and they're going to get an earful, especially some of the Pennsylvania delegation, not just to single them out, but some of the Republicans who won those elections in those areas and in the industrial Rust Belt areas, too, who voted for this globalization bill are going to hear a lot. And if you look at some of the sayings that are, you know, being posted on Facebook and Twitter, et cetera, you're seeing people from the right wing side that are just all over John Boehner. So I think if anything, Nancy Pelosi actually helped save the White House from some real problems in attempting to bail out, the House Republicans on this.
Very interesting. And yet she also said, you know, maybe we can come to the table on this if you'll give us a transportation bill. So she's not doing this on principle. She's doing it as a negotiating tactic. It looks like to me.
Well, that's the other problem that she has. She's got to win if she doesn't succumb to, you're going to bring down the Democrat Party. She's got to win if she doesn't succumb to that. If they get tricky and clever and tack on a
something else of that nature, I can tell you up on Capitol Hill, and people are nervous about it, it will bring a lot of wrath down on the Congress because it's just getting too cute of trading something for money.
Right.
And I think they got to be very careful of that.
Yeah, it's I am believing more and more, Bob, that the number one issue in this upcoming election is going to be political corruption, and this is just another dimension of it. You know, the corruption of our political process.
More, I think you're going to see a lot more also of the amount of monies, and once it has to either pass or not pass the bill, and I think you're going to see a lot more of the fundraising. Promises that were made out there. I think you're going to see a lot of that.
Yeah.
Speaking of the campaigns and money and fundraising, it's now Jeb, just simply JJ.
Yeah, he's trying to drop the Bush from his name.
That's it. So it's just Jeb, and he's going to have more problems than trying to actually ignore his last name. And I think the Donald Trump announcement today, although people are scoffing at it, says a lot. Donald Trump's going to come under a lot of scrutiny as an official candidate on finances, et cetera. And I think it's going to say a lot about why he's actually running, Tom. And I think it's because he knows that almost the entire base of the movers and shakers, with the exception of a couple of the big PAC guys, do not want Jeb Bush. They want no part of Jeb Bush for a lot of different reasons, not just philosophical, but also for the fact that if you watch his announcement, it looks like somebody forced him to be there.
Yeah.
So I think there's a long life left yet in this whole Republican debate, and Trump entering the race actually is more of, I think, shows the weakness of Jeb Bush, if anything.
Yeah, I'm putting my money on a Scott Walker, Brian Sandoval ticket on the Republican side. What do you think?
I thought about that, and Scott Walker, although if you talk to, you know, union friends, they'll be saying, well, you know, what can you talk, how can you be saying the name Scott Walker? But amongst the base, and I think the fact that the Koch brothers seem to be pretty excited about him and they provide the money,
right.
I think that's what you said is very, very plausible. I just don't think it's going to be Jeb Bush in the finale of this thing.
Yeah, I don't either. I don't think that the billionaire class is all that excited about Jeb Bush. And the base.
Right.
You're right about the base. So we got a minute left. What else is going on in the world, Bob?
Well, I wanted to mention the Benghazi hearings because this seems to be at least the last item that anyone can bring up from the Republican side on Benghazi. Now, there is no question that there's going to be a grilling today. Sidney Blumenthal offered to, you know, come to the committee, et cetera. And there were armed marshals that actually delivered. I mean, talk about drama that delivered it. And they've been looking for the fact of, you know, were all the emails turned in. But right now, at this point in time, it's up to state to see how many emails they have and whether they match the amount of emails that were sent by Sidney Blumenthal.
Right.
So it's yet to play out. I don't think there's a silver bullet there, though.
Yeah, I suspect you're right. I don't think there's a there.
I don't think.
And in fact, the Republicans in Congress issued a report a while back saying there was no there. But anyway. Bob Ney, Congressman Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Always great talking with you. Check out Bob's book, Sideswiped. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Waiting for my software to reopen. Wait, hang on just a second. Here we go. You've heard this once too often, right? We have the most unreliable internet service I have ever seen in my life here, thanks to which company do we have? We have Comcast, indeed. It's astonishing how unreliable it is. The Reverend Canon Sally Bingham is with us, the president and founder of Interfaith Power and Light, which is, no, it's not a public utility. Interfaith Power and Light, ANDLIGHT.org is the website. The church lady speaks out on climate change, Reverend Sally Bingham, Canon Sally Bingham. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me?
I hear you just fine, and thank you for joining
us. Good.
That's
good. So tell us, Pope Francis is preparing, and a first draft has already been leaked to the press, apparently, and a papal encyclical about climate change. Why is this an issue for the faith community?
Why is the encyclical an issue, or why is...
No, why is climate change...
Out here that it is.
Yeah, why is climate change an issue?
Well, climate change is affecting all aspects of life and everything that we consider sacred. So clearly something that disrupts crops and causes catastrophic weather conditions and causes droughts and severe storms is something that everybody cares about. It's not particularly for the religious community, but with someone as popular as Pope Francis coming out with this being a moral issue, it clearly is going to hopefully will be a game changer for those of us that care about climate.
Yeah, yeah. And what can you explain what a papal encyclical is?
It's a letter to all of the Roman Catholic bishops around the world, and it's one of the highest. It's not the highest level of teaching, but it's one of the highest levels of teaching. And this one is particularly important because there has never in history been an encyclical that's on ecology and justice,
really,
which is what this one is described to be.
Wow. And how has the faith community so far been dealing with climate change? Has there been any consequential activity? I mean, tell me about Interfaith Power and Light .org. What are you doing with this?
Well, 15 years ago, the Regeneration Project, which is our 501c3, launched a campaign called Interfaith Power and Light, with the idea that if congregations around the country would retrofit their buildings in environmentally sensitive ways, putting in energy efficient appliances, educating the people in the pews about how important it is to be the stewards of creation. Sometimes these congregations are able to put solar on their roofs, and then the congregation serves as an example to the community. Then we hope that if a clergy person can walk down the aisle and say, this congregation is creating jobs, saving money, and saving creation all at the same time, that people will kind of ingest that message and then take it back to their own homes and their own facilities and places where they work.
So you're helping churches electrify with solar power?
That's right. Well, we don't actually do the electrifying of the solar power, but we have resources and guidelines and five different models on how a congregation can put solar on the roof without any upfront cost to itself. And we have these different models on our website.
Wow. And I would assume that those models would work for any nonprofit or any organization?
Yes. And, of course, it's different between the secular buildings and the nonprofits, or between the nonprofits and the for-profits, in that the for-profits have been getting tax credits for years, but the nonprofits have not been getting those same credits. And we have done some political influencing to get the nonprofit world to be able to take credit, benefit for those credits.
Right.
And then some of the other ways it's done is through a third party person that wants tax credits, and the person can donate the solar to that congregation and get a tax credit. There are other ways where certain solar companies will actually put the solar up for you, maintain it, and then sell you your own created sun-powered roof electricity at a lower price than what you've been receiving from your local utility. And these different models and ways of doing it are on our website that people can go and look at and say, oh, well, this might work for us. Sometimes you have a member of a congregation who will put solar on the roof in memory of a loved one.
Hmm. That's great. So not only are you preaching the work, you're doing the work. I mean, it's...
Oh, absolutely. We are doing what you would call putting our faith into action.
Right, right. And are there you know, have any of the major denominations or the other, you know, or representatives of consequential groups in other religions, Islam, Judaism, Buddhism, Hinduism, I mean, have any of them started this, anything like what you're doing, to the best of your knowledge?
It's interesting you say have any of them. They all have. We are an entirely interfaith organization, and we have Hindus and Baha'is, we have Jains, we have Roman Catholics, and we have Jewish synagogues and all different denominations of Protestants. Almost every mainstream religion that we know of has a mandate within their theology to care for creation. So there's little resistance to making your facility or your house of worship an example for the community.
It's great. The Reverend Canon Sally Bingham, the president and founder of Interfaith Power and Light, the website interfaithpowerandlight.org. Reverend Bingham, thank you so much for being with us today.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. Great talking with you. Moving along back to our phone calls and anything goes summer. Billy in Wimberley, Texas. Hey, Billy, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, I was calling about this Rachel Dahl, whatever her name is.
Mm-hmm.
It's just another example of the way liberals lie, whatever the lie is, to further their agenda.
You think conservatives never lie, Billy?
Excuse me?
Do you think conservatives never lie?
That's not the point. Conservatives don't lie in the...
Shouldn't you then be saying this is an example of how human beings sometimes lie when it works to their advantage?
That's exactly what I'm saying. But the liberal agenda is based on lies.
Whether you're
talking about race, whether you're talking about sex, whether you're talking about
what's the lie?
Or guns
give me one lie, Billy.
Base your arguments
give
on
me one lie.
We'll do whatever you need to do.
I would be glad to give you conservative lies. You give me one liberal lie.
You can keep your doctor and your health care if you want to.
That is not...
Romney didn't pay his taxes. How do you like those?
Well, we don't know if Romney paid his taxes or not. He still has refused to release his tax returns.
Don't be complicit in the lie.
But neither of those are liberal lies. Those are statements made by individuals.
Harry Reid said one on the...
Conservative lies are things... I'm talking about concepts, Billy. A conservative lie is something like... If we cut taxes on rich people, it's going to make the nation more prosperous and the working people are going to make more money. That's a lie. But it is still promoted by conservatives. Sam Brownback is trying to do it. You know, it's continuing to do this in Kansas right now. It's a lie.
No, it's not.
No, it's not. When did it work and where?
You people lie to do whatever you lie whatever you can to get your agendas passed.
Yeah, right. Okay, Billy, thanks a lot for the call. It's always nice to hear from you. 15 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, in another 5 minutes, we'll be talking about liberals and sexiness. That should be entertaining. Get ready for your head to explode, Billy. Welcome back. By the way, our internet crashed for a few minutes, and so everybody who was on hold got dumped. If you had called in and you were on hold and you got dumped, that's what happened. And so feel free to call back, and we'd be pleased to put you on the air. We've got another 45 minutes here. Rick in Woodland Hills, California. Hey, Rick, you want to talk about the TPP?
Seems to me that we keep, a major part of this thing is unknown, obviously, and that it comes in and involves the cyber war that we're in the midst of with China and Russia, for that matter. There's a cyber battle going on, and Obama is commander-in-chief, so he knows a whole lot about this situation that he just can't tell us. It would be, because in a war, you can't let the other side know all your plans.
Right.
So it leaves us kind of guessing and flailing around as to what's going on. But that, I would say, is what's going on. His role as commander-in-chief is conflicting with his role.
What does the TPP have to do with cyber war?
Oh,
There's another agreement called the Trade and Services Agreement, TISA, that will basically make it illegal for a country to prevent corporations from taking over the Internet. But that's not the TPP. The TPP, to the best of my knowledge, says nothing about cyber war. Of course, I don't know. I mean, you know, there's 30 articles to it. Only three of them have been leaked by WikiLeaks.
Yeah, that's the problem. The observation is that we are in a cyber battle. What we don't talk about, because the nature of that, the whole fifth area that we're dealing with, the cyberspace information war department that we have, is all based on stealth and stuff like that. So you're not.
Well, they publicly announced when they created the United States Cyber Command. You know, it's like JSOC and, you know, all these kind of things. It's got its own. They've got their own logo. They've got their own buildings. They've got their.
Yeah, I know. It's right next to, you can see the sign where it's right next to the NSA.
Yeah.
You know, it's, that whole thing is involved in this, Tom. That whole area, we are, you know, every other day you see examples of that where Chinese hackers have, but these are major things that these guys do. The one that just came out involves millions of high security people that have been hacked into. There is a cyber battle going on there. It affects everything. It affects trade, because when they break in and steal finance stuff, that's our trade policy and everything.
Right. So, once again, just trying to understand what you're saying, Rick. Are you saying that you support the president negotiating this deal behind closed doors and shoving it through Congress without the ability to amend or even debate it consequentially, because Father knows best?
Well, not quite as simply as that, but I would add that Obama knows a lot more than we do about it, and he knows the aspects I'm talking about, the ones that are highly secretive and cannot be told because they would compromise our tactics.
It may well be true. I don't think so, but and you haven't convinced me, but I understand your perspective. Rick, and I know that a lot of people share it. Rick, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. And with us on the line is the sexy liberal herself. Back to Billy's call, but we just had a caller in the last block saying, "Oh, liberals always lie about everything." the sexy liberal herself, Stephanie Miller, the host of the Stephanie Miller Show. StephanieMiller.com is her website, and she has a new book that is about to come out. It's available for pre-order over at Amazon, called "Sexy Liberal of Me I Sing." Hey, Stephanie.
Hi, Tom. I've missed you so much since the TV show last night.
Yeah, it's great to see you again. Thank you for joining us. Just a record number of Americans are now calling themselves liberals. Why do you think that is?
Because of Sexy Liberal. I'm going to take full credit for that. And obviously, that includes you as the original Sexy Liberal. I think oddly, because God is a liberal and a comedian and has given us Donald Trump today and made Sexy Liberal the number one book on Amazon, I think it is, you know, it is the point that you and I have always been making, Tom, that these polls are no surprise to us. The American people largely agree with us on most of the major issues. And, you know, so that poll is showing that the country and Hillary is moving left. And, you know, our friend Bernie Sanders, as we've talked about, that has something to do with it, because I think that, you know, he's certainly not fringe. His ideas are very mainstream ideas. Donald Trump is a doofus.
Yeah. or something else that you can't see on. Did I ever tell you the story of when Louise walked up to Donald Trump at the correspondence dinner?
No.
Oh, it was hysterical. We were in the Washington Post party room before the speech, and Louise and I were standing there, and Donald Trump makes a grand entrance with his latest trophy wife and his two big burly security guards. And Louise just walks right up to him, stands about, a foot and a half away from him, looking at his face and his head. He's looking at her like, what's going on? And one of the security guys is starting to twitch. And then she just turns around, and everybody, and there's like maybe 20 people in kind of a circle around us looking at this. And then she turns around and says to me in a very loud voice, "Bad plugs."
Louise.
He turned bright red, turned around, and walked out of the room. It was amazing.
Yeah. You know what? The comedy gods were not good enough to us that he could have made his announcement in the wind today.
Yeah.
That there'll be a lot of campaign stops in the wind.
Yeah, there you go. So one of the things you talk about in your book is how you were raised by Republicans. Your dad was, Bill Miller. I campaigned for when I was 13 years old, 1964, as Barry Goldwater's running mate. So
it was probably less of a landslide because of you, Tom.
No doubt. The maybe 50 or 60 doors that I knocked on.
Thank you.
So tell us, how did you, coming from a Republican family, become a liberal?
And Hillary Clinton, a Goldwater girl, too,
yeah.
As you know.
Yep.
So my excuse is I was only three. So I hadn't said anything yet, hardly, Tom, so they can't blame me for the landslide. But, it's this conversation that we've had over and over again that, this latest poll just confirms – not that the country's even just gotten more liberal, but that this version of the Republican Party has gone off the rails to the right.
Yeah.
This is not my dad or Goldwater's party anymore. I mean, this is, as we've said many times, Barry Goldwater would be a crazy liberal. He'd be a socialist in today's Republican Party.
Yeah.
You look at all these, I don't know if we talked about this yesterday, but all these egregious abortion bills in state after state. First of all, what happened to the party of small government? And secondly, Barry Goldwater was incredibly pro-choice on the Senate floor in the 80s.
Right.
Pro-gay rights, has a gay grandson, on and on.
Yeah, he said you don't have to be straight to shoot straight.
Yeah.
He was in favor of gays in the military.
Yeah.
I mean, that was my dad's Republican Party, and I remember it, and I mourn the loss of it because it seems like, the Fox News has totally killed it. By the way, speaking of Fox News, I understand in your book you tell us the story of your mom's bird and Fox News. What's this?
Well, Tom, you nasty little man. You want to hear about the masturbating bird. I see how you seem all professorial and intellectual, but you want to know about my mom's bird that masturbates to Fox News.
Yes.
Yes. Well, it is something that you cannot unsee, Mr. Hartman. It is an image that will be seared in my brain because I thought she was kidding until I actually saw it. But he has this, little colorful chain, and I don't ask me what, just something about them getting going on a rant about the Kenyan socialist in the White House makes him just very excited. It's very disturbing.
Yeah.
It's just very disturbing.
I wonder if all over America there are birds in bird cages. These people in their 70s and 80s who are watching Fox News, and birds are going, oh!
Yes, yes, having little birdgasms nationwide.
Yes, birdgasms.
Yes.
Everything except the pigeons. They, of course, they're robots, but that's a whole other issue. Speaking of Fox News, in the last minute we've got here, they're making an effort to make conservatives seem sexy. It seems like, if you look at the kind of people they hire and the way that they present them and how much leg they show and whatnot, do you think it's working and does it match up with reality? And do you have advice for liberals in this election season to beef up their sexy factor?
Tom Hartman in a thong. How many times can I say it, Tom?
Okay.
Let's go. Do you
that
love
ain't happening.
America or
okay.
not? I think this is what we always said, Tom. It was a joke when we called it sexy liberal. We weren't talking about us. We were talking about you, about the audience. We were saying we think it's sexy to be liberal. It means you're empathetic. You're open-minded. You want to help other people. It's that great John F. Kennedy quote about what it means to be a liberal, right?
Yeah. I will have to play that, in fact, in the next segment because it is so good. So
you would just have that right at your fingertips, Tom Hartman, because you're Tom Hartman.
Yeah, but I don't want to play it over you. So, Stephanie Miller, her new book out is "Sexy Liberal of Me I Sing," and Stephanie, thanks so much for dropping by.
Thanks, Tom. I like it when you're giggly.
Thank you. You make me that way all the time, Stephanie Miller. You're wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you, too.
StephanieMiller.com as well. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And back with your calls right after this. It's Anything Goes Summer. Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman Program. And Stephanie Miller brought up JFK's speech on what it means to be a liberal, at least in the minds of John Kennedy. Here it is.
What do our opponents mean when they apply to us the label liberal? If by liberal they mean, as they want people to believe, someone who is soft in his policies abroad, who is against local government, and who is unconcerned with the taxpayer's dollar, then the record of this party and its members demonstrate that we are not that kind of liberal. But if by a liberal they mean someone who looks ahead and not behind, someone who welcomes new ideas without rigid reactions, someone who cares about the welfare of the people, their health, their housing, their schools, their jobs, their civil rights and their civil liberties, someone who believes that we can break through the stalemate and suspicions that grip us in our policies abroad, if that is what they mean by a liberal, then I'm proud to say that I'm a liberal.
There you go. John Kennedy. We miss him. He'd be over 100 years old now. That's amazing to think. Yeah, his 100th birthday was, I think, last year. Maybe the year before. I remember when it happened. So anyway, back to the phone call. Sanjeeva in Ames, Iowa. Welcome to the program.
All right. Thank you, Tom. I'm actually, yeah, I was reading an article on Salon by some guy named Bill Curry. I think it said on the bottom that he was an advisor for President Clinton and he resigned after the welfare thing. I think there was a bunch of people who resigned after the Welfare Reform Act.
Right.
Well, anyway, he was saying how Bernie Sanders should maybe go beyond just criticizing Citizens United and sort of bring a more like complete, a holistic anti-corruption campaign for Washington, D.C. Because, I mean, even before Citizens United, we've had corruption scandals like with Jack Abramoff and so on.
Right. Yeah, Bernie's been pretty outspoken about all those things. He says what we need is public financing of our elections, period. Let's get all the money out of politics. And I'm with him on that. But in order to do anything like that, first you have to strike down these two doctrines that were wholly invented by the Supreme Court. No legislative body ever considered them, that the spending of money on politics is protected by the First Amendment, that it's called free speech, which it's not. The founders did not envision, you know, an aristocracy or a plutocracy. And that the 14th Amendment, when it says all persons are equal to, you know, are entitled to equal protection under the law, that the 14th Amendment applies to corporations as well as human beings. Those two doctrines need to be struck down. And Bernie has actually authored and submitted to the Senate on numerous occasions constitutional amendments to do just that. So he's very much ahead of that curve, and that would be necessary. Congress right now can't pass anti-corruption laws because the corruption has been legalized by the Supreme Court, which is why, you know, most Americans, you know, it's like we're, you know, Congress's approval ratings are in the single digits. Most Americans think that most members of Congress are hopelessly corrupt, and they think that because the Supreme Court has set up a system where, you know, it's a buyer's market. And it's terrible. Sanjeeva, thank you very much for the call. Ken in Parrington, Michigan. Hey, Ken, what's up?
Hello, Tom. Been a while since I've been on, but you gave me some hard people to follow here. Anyway, it's with TPP.
Okay.
And what I'm kind of hoping here is that we are witnessing probably the ultimate chess game between Obama and those who support the TPP. And I think what's going on, maybe, and maybe it's more hope than no, is that he is playing the game of, okay, everything I like, you hate. So why not support this right to the very end? And then it'll be almost time for the elections, and his term will be just about over. And nothing says he can't just say, I changed my mind.
No, Ken, this is – I really believe that Michael Froman has – who worked in the Clinton administration with Robert Rubin, and these were the guys who talked Bill Clinton into NAFTA And he is the guy that he went to law school with Obama. He's the he worked as the senior executive at Citigroup, made millions, and then came back as Obama's trade representative. And I think you know, Michael Froman is shilling for the big transnational corporations, and is lying to Obama, or at least is not representing honestly what this deal is. I'm increasingly convinced that that's the case, that he's just living in some kind of a bubble. The exact same thing happened with Bill Clinton. You know, most Democrats, there were only 30-some-odd Democrats in the House of Representatives who voted for NAFTA. The majority of Democrats opposed it. Clinton had to have Republicans to pass that. And that was in 93. And in 94, in that election, 16 of those 30 Democrats lost their seats because who had voted for NAFTA because they voted for NAFTA. And I predict that you know, if the TPP passes, or even if Fast Track passes, which, of course, will set up TPP, and not just TPP, SHAFTA, but also a whole bunch of other, the TPIS, the Trade and Services Agreement, that will do away with our ability to have government regulate the Internet, and then the deal with Europe, that when those things happen, that in the next election, those Democrats, I think, are going to go down in flames. And I've even said, you know, I'd like to write the first check. Well, I can't say the first check. I'd like to endorse the first progressive who wants to primary Earl Blumenauer or any of these other Democrats who are just gung-ho on this, because this is a sellout of America, of our country, in my opinion. Ken, thank you for the call. Corky in Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky, what's up?
Yeah, Tom, I just called to tell you, you're not wrong. When you enter the presidency, you enter a bubble in the White House. That's why he has this trusted advisors to tell him what's going on out in the country.
Right.
But men in that position are not adverse to taking money to change their minds about what they tell him. Now, he don't know what's going on out here, but what his trusted advisors tell him. Like you said, he brought one, some guy from Wall Street in to be with him.
Right.
His friend in
it. Well, he's had Wall Street guys in the top economic positions in his administration from day one.
All right. Now, let me tell you what I know that's going on. There's two conversations going on. One, they tell the president, if you do this, it'll be good for your legacy. The same thing they told him in his first administration.
Right.
If you do this, it'll create millions of jobs. They tell him this will be good for your legacy, and so on and so on. And the other conversation that's going on is in the boardrooms of these companies. They're telling their execs, look, wrap these machines up and get them on pallets, because as soon as this trade deal is completed, we got people in Vietnam looking for real estate to set up our manufacturing.
Yep.
That's the two conversations going on.
Yep, I agree.
And nobody's going to admit to it. They're liars. They're scum is what they are. They don't care about the American people. All they care about is their mighty dollar.
Yeah, yeah. I'm uncomfortable with characterizing anybody as scum, but everything else, I absolutely agree with you, Corky. Thanks a lot for the call. Carl in Lucerne, California. Hey, Carl, you wanted to get back to the issues of race.
Yeah, Tom. You were talking about that previous caller was talking about the black community hitting the J curve and is going to lead to violence, in his opinion.
Yeah.
It got me to thinking about how the white community hits the J curve, how they're going to think peaceful protesting is going to work. But when the black community hits the J curve, they're probably not going to think peaceful protesting is going to work because of the way they've been treated.
Yeah, Ken, just to interrupt you for just a second here, Carl, for people who don't know what you and I are talking about, it's been a while since I've done a show on the J-curve. The J-curve is basically, and I forget who invented it, but it's this idea that what causes revolution or even small, you know, protest, riots, things like that, all the way up to revolution, is not when conditions become intolerable. There are people all over the world living under intolerable conditions. They're expecting it to be intolerable, and it is intolerable, and so they're not revolting. But when people's expectations diverge sufficiently far away from what the reality is, if their expectations are going up and their reality is going down, that J curve, that when that curve hits a certain point, the certain amount of distance between expectations and reality, that's when people revolt. And you're saying that. You're suggesting that it works differently in the black community and the white community?
Well, I'm suggesting because of the way they're treated. We don't have unarmed citizens being gunned down every 26 hours.
You're right. You're right. You're right.
So expectations are going to be totally different.
Right.
We don't have people. We have white privilege. They don't.
Right.
So when we come to the J curve, we're going to think peaceful protesting. Yeah, we could do it. They're probably not.
Right. Because they've already tried that.
And they already tried it. They've been trying it for decades.
Yeah. It was James Davies, by the way, according to Shano, who invented the J curve. For anybody who wants to be learning more about it. Very, very interesting. I suspect that a lot of America, when it comes to economics, we're all riding that J curve together. And that's why I think this election, this is why Bernie Sanders is doing so well all over the country, in my opinion, is that people are just sick and tired of business as usual, because business as usual, since we flipped out of FDR's Keynesian economics model, which prevailed from the 1930s until the 1980s, into Reagan's Thatcherism, Reaganism, trickle-down economics model that we've still been in. I mean, Bill Clinton and Barack Obama as well. We expected that America would continue down the road of getting more prosperous and the middle class growing the way it did until Reagan came along. And then the Reagan Revolution blew everything up. And now white and black, I mean, and all races, we're all suffering. But interesting point, Carl. Thank you for calling and making it. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with your calls, questions, thoughts, answers, comments, critiques, right after this. Welcome back. Norma in Montgomery, Alabama. Hey, Norma. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind? Norma? Don't tell me Comcast has done it to us again. Okay, let's try Scott in Minneapolis watching Free Speech TV on Roku. Scott, can you hear me?
I can hear you, Tom.
Great. So what's up?
Well, I just want to thank you for all the tools and arguments you've given me throughout the years. We need tools, like, you know, how do we become precinct captains and delegates for Bernie? And maybe we need a progressive Democrat database where we have all kinds of unbiased, you know, footnoted and researched facts that we can pull out of our back pocket. So,
well, Bernie's got a pretty good list of those over at BernieSanders.com. There's a sub-menu on his website that is Bernie on the Issues, and he lays out every single one of them.
Excellent. That's what I want to hear. It's easy for people to complain about this and that, but we need tools, and we have to go out and get active.
Yeah. Yeah. Bernie's in this for real. He's actually running for president of the United States, and I think that there's actually a reasonable chance that he could be our next president. I think it would be the best thing. It would be like, you know, George Washington winning the Revolutionary War. It would be like Abraham Lincoln winning the Civil War. It would be like FDR being elected in 1932. It would be one of those every 80-year revolutions, and I think America is ripe for it right now. Scott, thanks for the call. Check out BernieSanders.com for the information. Denise in Calumet, Michigan. Hey, Denise, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Can you hear me?
Yes, just fine.
Oh, good. First, I want to say really quick, we the people are Bernie Sanders' super PAC. And his website is awesome. But I was going to talk to you about Michigan roads. Our think tanks down in Lansing have decided that they're going to try to put through legislation to take away all of the low-income tax credits and the middle-class tax credits to pay for. It's been voted on yet, but that's what they're trying to do.
Wow. So it's just like Sam Brownback in Kansas. He gave huge tax cuts to the Koch brothers and the other billionaires and multimillionaires, and now he's paying for it by raising taxes on the bottom 20% on the poorest people in Kansas. And you're saying that Rick, what's your governor's name?
Snyder.
Yeah, Rick Snyder.
Yep.
Rick Snyder and the Republicans there in Michigan are essentially doing the same thing, only to pay for their roads.
Right. They can't think about doing anything except the only thing they can think about is how to make life worse for the lower class and the poor. That's their only thought process.
Well, yeah, that's remarkable. Denise, is there any pushback happening in Michigan right now on this?
I'm hoping so, and that's why I keep calling you about the Michigan roads, because I'm putting stuff on Facebook I'll supported you on Facebook to
Thank
everybody
you.
On my thing, your fund drive. I'm sorry,
mm-hmm.
but you know, I think it's kind of being pretty quiet. I haven't heard anything except from my dad.
Wow. You might want to check pdamerica.org, progressivedemocratsofamerica.org, and see if there's a Michigan chapter. I don't know if there's one near Calumet, but and movetoamend.org has over 500 chapters all around the country. You might want to look for them. Another one, if you drink, is Drinking Liberally. Drinking Liberally groups around the country are just great, and there are other Liberally groups for people who don't drink. There's Screening Liberally, where people get together and go to a movie. There's Bowling Liberally. I mean, so you can find local groups of people of similar mind. Denise, good luck. Thank you for the heads up. 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Linda in Hyattsville, Maryland. Hey, Linda, what's up?
Hi, Tom. So glad to get in on your show. I think you have a great show. Thank you.
Thank you.
I wanted to talk about the Rachel Dolezal
mm-hmm.
thing. Controversy. Tom, I'd just like to know, you're in the media, and the media is just demonizing this woman as if she has done something so wrong. What I want to know is, what is the difference between her and transsexuals like Bruce Jenner? Now, this lady says she's identified as she's wanted to be an African-American student. She was about
no, she
five.
Said she's identified as black, not as African American. She's talking about the cultural identity rather than the racial identity.
But what I want to say is, this lady, all that she had to do to look black, she got a really deep tan and she curled her hair. To me, she looked like an attractive black woman. Okay, and she's saying that she is. When you look at a transgender person, look at what they do. They have to have this invasive plastic surgery. They have to take hormones, if it's a male, female hormones for their lives. And, I mean, the surgery that they have is ridiculous. And they can never change their sex, because if you look at Bruce Jenner or any other one, his chromosomes are still XY.
Right.
He is a man who is living as a woman, and he has everybody. If he wants to do that, fine, let him do it. But the media says, oh, now we have to call him, and anybody can change their name. So I don't have a problem with that either. But
right.
we have to call him a she, and
right.
we have to use the pronoun her. But when this lady says this, they start putting up pictures of her when she was a young girl. She's lying. I mean, they've used this term. She's lying.
Right.
Nobody has attacked Bruce Jenner that way or any other transsexual. It's contradictory.
Linda, do you identify as white or black or something else, if you don't mind my asking?
I'm an African-American.
You're an African-American. So, because what I've had a number of African-Americans call and say they're very offended by what Rachel did. It's interesting to hear you say no big deal, basically.
I am not offended at all. I'm not offended at all, because I feel like this. Race is, it's a very fluid kind of thing. It's cultural. I mean, it's a lot of things, race,
yeah.
when you think about it. And why I just, when I heard this, because I can tell you, Tom, I'm not going to lie about anything. I don't agree with the transgenders and the transsexuals, but I feel that everybody to be able to do what they want. But when you have government allowing people to change their birth certificate, to me, that is ridiculous on the face of it. If
yeah.
you're born, whatever you're born, that's what you are. Now, if they wanted to issue some kind of identification thing.
Well, if you're saying however you're born, that's how you are, then shouldn't you be criticizing Rachel?
No, because her race was put on her birth certificate by her parents, but that's not something that her DNA is going to attest to. DNA does not attest to your race.
Right.
Not at all. But DNA does attest to your gender.
Well, there's, I mean, if you aggregate enough individual genes, you can pretty much calculate somebody's race. I mean,
no, you can trace ancestry. You can determine ancestry, but DNA does not determine skin color.
Well, no, DNA does actually determine skin color. It's just it's not the exact same gene. I mean, the gene that does facial features, the gene that does skin color, the gene that does hair, they're all eye color. They're all different genes. They're all different parts of the genome. So there's not one single gene that this is the gene for race. But when you aggregate them all together, you can.
Then I guess you can have dark skin, but that doesn't make you an African American.
Right.
You can have white skin, but that doesn't make you a Caucasian.
Right.
But if your chromosomes are XY or your chromosomes are XX, then you are a male or you are a female, and
right.
you cannot change that.
Right.
And the media is just being, to me, totally contradictory. And I don't have a problem. And the other news flash that I would like to talk about is, I think white America is mortified to think what would happen if we had these transracial people who could change their physical appearance and then say that they want to be Caucasian.
Well, that's been that, you know.
American, but you would have a lot of African Americans, Asians, Hispanics, who might be out there and say, "Oh, I've identified with the Caucasian race, with the white race. Maybe I was
right.
adopted, raised in white families, raised in white culture, and that's all I have ever wanted to be."
Well, Jeb Bush checked Hispanic on his voter registration form. I mean, Jeb Bush, on his voter registration form, he said that he was Hispanic. His wife is from Mexico, but he's not.
Well, he's not. Is anybody jumping on him for that?
Well, yeah, actually. I did.
I'm going to tell you, I just heard this from you. I haven't heard it. But why would Jeb Bush put that? Nobody's jumping on him. But see, that's a different thing, because race sells if it's an African-American. And then society, I guess they cannot believe that a white woman would want to give up that white privilege and say that she's an African American.
Right.
Oh, what is wrong with her?
Right. Yeah, and that was explicitly the question I was asking yesterday. Necessarily something's wrong with her. It's just it's very rare. It's very unusual.
But it wouldn't be so rare if African Americans wanted to do that.
Yeah, no, although it was illegal in this country for 400 years, and it's not any longer. Linda, thank you for a thoughtful conversation. I appreciate it. Thank you for the call. And thanks for listening to SiriusXM. That's it for the day. We will be back tomorrow. And don't forget, in the meantime, democracy is not a spectator sport. It does require all of us to show up. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great one.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit tomhartman.com.